Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and welcome to returning guest, Will Jewell.
Hello. Hi.
Hiya. You were on here last time, as, and you still are, the writer-director of Concrete Plans. Do you want to give us a brief synopsis to what Concrete Plans is all about?
Yeah, certainly. Concrete Plans, it's about a group of, sort of ragtag group of builders who go to renovate a farmhouse off of a mountain in Wales. And they kind of get ripped off by the rich aristocratic owner who's inherited this farmhouse. And there's plays on a lot of the social tensions. And obviously it was developed over the last 5-6 years where we had the referendum and Brexit and everything. And a lot of those kind of tensions that have been in the air and the divisions, a lot of those kind of feed into it. One of the characters, the builder, is played by Goran Bogdan, is an East European migrant builder, and there's tensions there and prejudices, and then the things kind of bubble along, and then the wheels come off, and things start to kind of they turn on one another, and when they realise that they were never going to get paid, and it turns pretty bleak. There's a lot of sort of allegory and social commentary underneath what is a fairly tough, gritty thriller.
Indeed, and that's inspired you to come back on and give us 5 great anti-establishment films, which we'll get to in a moment or two. But first of all, where are you with Concrete Plans? How can people see it?
Well, unfortunately, our cinema run release date was slap in the middle of lockdown when all the cinemas were shut. So it went straight to digital. So it's on Apple TV, it's on Sky, it's on Amazon, it's on iTunes, all the usual suspects in the UK. It's been released in America. So it's on a lot of digital channels over there. It's in Latin America, and we're currently negotiating release in Australia and Japan. So we are actually doing a few one-off Q&A screenings in now cinemas have reopened, hopefully stay open again with Omicron. We've done a few one-off Q&A screenings, which have been amazing to see on the big screen with an audience. So keep your eyes peeled. There are a few of those more to come up.
Is there a website or anything people can check, or Twitter accounts to follow or anything?
Yeah, concreteplans.co.uk. Once we got some more Q&A dates, we'll put them up on there.
Cool. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes so people can see that. What have you been up to most recently? Anything you want to tell us about?
I was teaching directing actors via Zoom during lockdown, which was a bit frustrating. As soon as we could get out of lockdown, I went and shot a short sort of semi-improvised Dead Flowers, which is going out to festivals now, which is a bit more kind of black comedy rather than, you know, Concrete Plans is pretty tough, gritty. And I'm currently scripting a sort of dystopian futuristic script called Ultra, which is a sort of 8-parter that I'm working with a fairly big production company to develop. Set in a sort of, it's my elevator pitch is it's Black Mirror meets Chariots of Fire. Everyone seems to look confused when I say that. It's a sort of Olympics with all the restrictions lifted, essentially, and how fast could a man run, and it's about someone who gets sucked into this world. It's all very much Nietzsche versus God, and sort of where's the line blur, superhumans, all this. So it's interesting. I'm almost finished the pilot at the moment. So.
How fast can a human run with scientific intervention?
Well, this is the, you'll have to watch Ultra when it comes out and find out.
Excellent. Thank you for all that. We're going to get into your into what we're calling five great anti-establishment films, which flows nicely from your own film, Concrete Plans. The rules of the show are straightforward, but for those that have not heard the format before of the five times five, Will has picked five films and we'll spend 5 minutes tops talking about each one. And each time 5 minutes elapse, there'll be a ringing alarm. For years, I've had a dog barking, but we're trying something new for this show, which is going to come ringing down Will's ears as well as my ears. so that'll go off on 5 minutes. And at that point, I can passively aggressively say, let's move on to the next film. But, you know, I won't be too impolite that I won't let Will finish his sentence if he's going to make a point. And often I've sometimes got to question myself, so I even break my own rules. But it's more about us trying to keep to roughly about the same length of time per film and not spending 20 minutes talking about any of the films and then 5 minutes on four films. It's like, because they all could be a show in themselves, and that's always the case with this format. Without further ado, Will, does that make sense?
That would make sense, yep.
Well, look, I'm going to start the clock. And your first choice is 1957's The Admiral Crichton.
Yeah, I adore this film, The Admiral Crichton. So Stuart said to do the films in chronological order. So this is the oldest one. What I didn't realise until I kind of rewatched it and read up a bit more about it and last week was actually from a play written by J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan.
Indeed he did, yes.
But it's a lot of the films on this list, because we're dealing with sort of anti-establishment and people sort of fighting back against the oppressive system. A lot of the films are quite overt and quite kind of brutal in the way people fighting back. This is a very gentle film, but it's very so it's very different to some of the other films on this list. But I think it's almost more powerful as a result of that. It's such a beautiful microcosm of society. So essentially, it's a very British film, all rooted in sort of the class structure. And it's about Kenneth Moore plays Crichton, who is a butler for this posh family, Lord Loam. This posh family have they're not cardboard cutouts. They have some fairly progressive ideas. Lord Loam thinks that the servants should, you know, they should engage with them and not see them as lower down. One of the family sports the suffragettes, which is obviously a big no-no. And so to basically get away from this societal faux pas, the whole family go on this, they've got a massive great yacht because they're rich, to around the South Pacific Islands. And there's a storm, the yacht sinks, and they end up washing up on this desert island.
Well, where are the blazers of the other boats?
I fear we drifted apart during the night, my lord. If indeed we are not the sole survivors.
Well, it's a lovely afternoon anyway.
Crichton, who is this person?
Her name is Eliza, my lady.
And what is her position in the household?
On the tweeny, your ladyship.
The what?
A between maid, my lady. That is to say, she is not, strictly speaking at the moment, anything.
Are we to understand you two are keeping company?
Oh, my lady, a butler don't keep company.
Indeed.
Let us say, I have cast a favourable eye upon her.
Land!
Eh, what?
Look!
If you please, Mr. Johnson.
Is it land, Crichton?
Undoubtedly, my lord.
Well, how long before we reach it?
We should be ashore before long.
Ashore? But we can't go ashore like this. How can we possibly meet the governor in our condition?
My hair's a sight.
Well, what are we to wear? Are we to stay in government house without a maid between us?
If I might suggest, my lady, as a temporary expedient...
What? Oh, Mr. Cardinal, couldn't...
Her manners, as you may have observed, are deplorable. But she has a homely appearance and a heart of gold.
Possibly. But I'm afraid she will not do. Quite impossible. Quite.
When you kind of all of the society hierarchy and scaffolding stripped away, it kind of becomes quite apparent fairly early on that the aristocratic family are fairly inept and hopeless because they've had everything done for them forever. So you've got Crichton, who is the butler, who is an officer, he's returned from the war. He's very practical. He knows how to survive. There's a point, so he kind of starts to take charge, and there's a point when they need to go, he's going to swim out to the boat and get supplies from the wreck of the boat. And all the rich aristocratic family want luxuries and things. And he's like, we need to survive. We need to get vitals and practical stuff. And there's a bit of a schism between them, and him and Tweeny, who's the maid, go off. And the family realise they can't survive without him. So he basically, they're trapped on this island for 2 years. He becomes de facto leader. And all the lords and the ladies, they all defer to him. They call him Gov. And they develop this kind of upside down society where essentially all of the hierarchy isn't based on money and wealth and inherited family names. It's based on merit and what you can do on the and he becomes the god of the island, essentially. It's this beautiful little flip, to the extent there's a bit of a love triangle with him and Tweenie the maid, but actually the daughter of the posh family, he's about to marry her. When they spot a ship on the horizon, and they've always built this big beacon that they're going to light when they see a ship. But actually, the aristocratic family, they're so blissfully happy there, they don't want to light the beacon. And it's actually, what I find is just crushing in it, is it's Crichton who says, no, we must light the beacon. So they light the beacon, the ship sees it, and the scene that just breaks my heart every time I see the film is Crichton then goes to his hut and puts on his butler's servant's uniform. And then they get rescued by the ship and they go back to society, and all of those old strictures and hierarchies are reinforced. And I'm like, oh, I find it uncomfortable watching when he does that. But it's almost like you've been gaslit by the system that is know your place in that way.
I was going to say that's because from what I read about it, it's like his character is about, he believes everyone should know their place in life.
Mm.
So even though, is it, even though that sequence sort of breaks your heart, as it were, is it evident that that's going to happen, or is it a surprise to the audience that he doesn't accept his role?
Yeah, you're kind of watching through your fingers going, I just don't do it. But there is a little kind of sting in the tail that when he gets back, he actually, because he's been out doing all the swimming and he's got some pearls. So he actually has his get out card, and he says, look, everyone reverts the type. And when they get home, the aristocratic family, one writes a book saying, I was the hero. And the other one's saying, I was the hero on the island. I did everything. And they all try and rewrite history. And he kind of, I'm not taking this. And the daughter who he's going to marry still wants to go back to the island with him and go back and reclaim their paradise. Because no, look, civilization, we can't do that. We can't go backwards. So him and Tweenie the maid actually leave when he quits a life of servitude. He's got his pearls from the island and they go off to start their new life. So there is a kind of, he strikes out on his own at the end, which is good. It's when he goes back to willingly being a servant. You kind of like, oh, no, it crushes you. But it's such a beautifully observed kind of treatise on the hierarchy and structure of class. It's beautiful.
Blimey, you were like you'd scripted it. Well, thank you for that. It was just a signal you'd finished speaking. Fantastic. Well, look, here's a film I am much more familiar with, Lindsay Anderson's 1968, or is it 1970? I couldn't quite work out when it was released. It's sort of
68, I think.
I've got 68 on the Wikipedia page, December, and then I've got 1970 on the Empire magazine review. So I was a bit confused, but my DVD, I think, is 68.
I watched it again last week, because 1970 was Oh Lucky Man, the follow up to it.
Well, that was 73.
On 73, is it right?
Okay. Yeah. And Britannia Hospital 82, but we'll get onto that in a second. So, yes, we're talking about Lindsay Anderson's If.
Yes. So, sort of moving from the gentle kind of poking of societal structures in Admirable Crichton to If, which is a far more, a bit more brutal. Very much, it's funny, I rewatched it. It's very much of its time. I think it is 68. When you think in 68, you've got the French student riots and revolutions. You've got another film that almost made this list, Easy Rider, around that same time, where they're very much kind of, that was the period where the generation gap had never been bigger, that the generation felt they'd lost control, that the studios didn't know, they wanted to make Doris Day films and the kids didn't want to watch them, so they kind of handed the keys to all these film students coming out. And you've got films like, there's a sort of naivety to this. I wonder, rewatching it the other week, I was kind of thinking, this film now would feel very, I don't know, very naive, because it's about, there was that revolution was in the air at that point, that it did feel that, oh my God, you know, it was happening in France. It could happen here. There could be a takeover. So it's interesting when films like this use metaphor and allegory. So they use this old public school as a metaphor for society, in which you've got the masters and you've got the whips that are the kind of the brutal chief prefects who, you know, they reinforce this structure and hierarchy with, you know, really brutal canings, and everyone, it's all steeped in tradition. And the headmaster says at the end about, you know, this school's been here 500 years, you know, a quarter of the time Christendom's been around. So everything is steeped in tradition.
Jolly, jolly good Stephens.
So
Jolly, jolly good, Steffens. Jolly, jolly good.
Oh, jolly, jolly good, Steffens. Jolly, jolly good.
You three have got to watch it.
Don't push us, Steffens. The day's coming.
What day? One night we're going to massacre you, Steffens. I'll do you for free.
Townside windows and skylights open tonight.
You got these three students, which are Malcolm McDowell and David Wood, and I can't remember the other guy, who kind of don't accept the rules. They won't fit in. You're at that point where they keep being told to get their hair cut. It's the late 60s. He goes off and steals a motorbike, has a fling with this girl, Christine Noonan. And they just refuse to toe the line and go along with all the establishment hierarchy. They keep butting heads with the
I mean, wits. I think the bit that sort of, I guess, that makes it stand seem of its time is that, like you say, using that kind of blunt tool of public school as a metaphor for society, when if you fast forward even sort of 10 years on from this, you've got scum, and scum is a much better metaphor for what, again, that kind of generational divide and the idea of I'll beat you till you respect me. And that'll make you a better person for society kind of thing. And that feels like, whereas, you know, Lindsay Anderson feels like, you know, the story, you know, they feel like they've written a story about we were oppressed because there was a couple of angry prefects and a strict headmaster, but you were walking out of school into every privileged life could ever offer you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they do make that point in there about, you know, they talk about what the fees are for the, they said you are a life of privilege. So there is that thing, they are sort of rich kids rebelling. But there is, I think, with a lot of, this is almost an embodiment of the sort of wish fulfillment film in terms of particularly the end scene where they get the machine guns and they're mowing everyone down, which, you know, I'm not convinced happens because they've got the surrealist inserts. The film's called If. His character of Mick Travis then appears in Oh Lucky Man and another film, whereas you're thinking, if you've just kind of mown down a dozen people, would that happen? So it's very kind of, you've got the black and white sequences and there's the whole, you know, Is it wish fulfillment? Is it, okay, when we just get things come to a boiling point, we're just going to kind of take, we've found this stash of guns.
The black and white is really interesting because it feels like a really interesting artistic choice when in reality they'd run out of money and they couldn't afford colour stock. So they just made the film they could make, which sounds ludicrous for a real cinematic release that there wouldn't have been the money found. But it's one of the benefits of it, I guess, as we look at it with 21st century eyes, is that it feels like it's the schism between the past and the future, because colour's the future, black and white's the past, and it's happening in the same film.
Totally, and he was influenced by the sort of the French guys of the 50s, the Cahiers du Cinéma guys, so he kind of could have that license. There's so many great quotes in it as well. It's only when I rewatched it recently, I realised that Dread Zone song, that whole, Britain is a powerhouse. Britain today with ideas, creativity. I didn't realise that's where that sample came from for that track.
Britain today is a powerhouse. Ideas, experiment, imagination.
Yeah, there's the whole thing about, you know, you can change the world with a bullet in the right place. It was that kind of slightly naive student revolutionary feel that feels, you know, like you said, even 10 years later, felt a little naive.
I mean, I'm just thinking now, was Altamont, was that 68 or 69?
Yeah, 69. Around that time when things started to sour, wasn't it?
Because that's the end of the hippie dream. That's the revolution's over. Authority, the authorities that were, will always be. The change isn't coming.
Totally. The key line in this was, which side will you be on? Because it felt like the revolution was...
Go on, finish your thought.
I was going to say, because it felt like the revolution was coming. It was happening in France. So it was, which side will you be on come the glorious day? And that, and this is that kind of wish fulfillment aspect of anti-establishment films that we can take over and we will rise up. Whereas, you know, it's like you said, that was maybe a blip in time where that did feel it was in the air and didn't take too long for that to kind of pass maybe. But,
no, and if you think, I mean, we think about going back to your point about Brexit in relation to your own film, like the 1970s that follow this, is where the unions try to fight back against the march of capitalism and they don't win. By the 80s, they're losing faster and faster their relevance, and we're about to enter 19 years of a Tory government which we didn't anticipate either. Now, jumping forward, we're going to jump over the 70s now and land in the 80s for your next film, which is one of my favourites. I mean, Time Bandits is one of my all-time favourites films of ever. It's like I could argue probably it's the reason that I want to make films is watching Time Bandits 100 plus times. It's just one of them. And now as a writer, I still don't know how you make a film like Time Bandits. It doesn't make any sense. And I think you could apply the same notion to Terry Gilliam's Brazil from 1985.
I absolutely love this film. I think it's probably the most visually ravishing and stunning film on this list. It's just, I rewatched it again a couple of nights ago and it's basically Orwell meets Monty Python, and it's got that.
Which is an insane pitch, isn't it? But it's so right.
Look at this.
It's a check.
It's the refund for Tuttle.
Tuttle?
No, it's Buttle. I mean, Buttle. It's been confusion from the word go. He's been overcharged for information retrieval procedures, and someone somewhere is trying to make us carry the can.
Can I have a look? I've never seen a refund check before.
I bet it's Jeffries. Yes. He always believes that people should pay more for their interrogation, and B, he loathes me. We've got to get rid of it.
Well, send it to somebody else. Better still, send it to Buttle. After all, it's his check.
I've tried that, but look at this. You see, the population census has got him down as dormanted. The central collective storehouse computer has got him down as deleted.
Hang on.
Information retrieval has got him down as inoperative. And there's another one, security has got him down as excised. Administration has got him down as completed.
He's dead.
Dead? Well, that's awful. We'll never get rid of that damn thing now.
The visuals in it are almost cartoonish, yet it's so dark, the subject matter, and it touches on consumerism, corporate governance, it's surveillance being everywhere, extreme plastic surgery. There's so much in there that's, we think this was 1985, how much has kind of, it's been very prescient, but it's such a bold film. The production design I just think is amazing. But even things like, casting National Treasure Michael Palin as being this smiling but really evil torturer guy, and just like the moves like that, and De Niro in a tiny little bit part. It's just so much about that film, the dreams being escapism, the sort of crushing authority, and just the use of the vents as symbolism, that is central government coming into everyone's house, and there's so much in it. And it was a big visual influence. I did a film called Man in Fear about 10 years ago, a little short that kind of got me to making Concrete Plans and is now in development as a feature.
Yeah.
Which was about conceptual artists who create accidents as works of art. It's based on the kind of YBAs. And we had Luke Treadaway walking to a police station, very bloodied, telling this ridiculous story to Tim Healy, who was the policeman, about these artists who are trying to kill me, and they've made me the subject of this piece. And it's such an absurdist Kafka-esque kind of premise that I naturally, Brazil became the touchstone for it. And even I love in Brazil the way that it's kind of riffs a bit on Fritz Lang, where the desks, whenever they go anywhere, the desks are up to here to make everyone feel so small and impotent. So we actually, when we were shooting Man in Fear, we took out the ceiling tiles and shot really high down onto Luke Treadaway, so he looks like a little child. Then we put the camera on the floor shooting up to get the other way.
Okay, and that's interesting.
Actually had the film that the policeman is filling in is Form 27B/6, which is the one they refer to in Brazil. So I just think Brazil is, satire is such a strong way of kind of making points. I think if you hammer people over the head and say, do people want to pay to go to the cinema, go across town, get babysitted, you see a film that reminds them how shit their lives are. But if you dress it up as beautifully visual satire or sci-fi or however it is, it's great. You're being entertained and you're being slipped all the messages, and you're well aware of those messages. But I love the extreme bureaucracy of it all as well, and how just those little something small happens that has massive reverberations. So when the fly falls into the typewriter and it goes from Buttle to Tuttle or Tuttle to Buttle, whichever way around it is,
yeah,
and sets all these chain of events in motion. And I love the way that the kind of Heath Robinson, very practical, the machines, and it's just everything about that film. I think it's subversive, but it's like a cartoon. It's just, I think it's one of the most underrated films in a way. I think it's
It's interesting. Upon release, Universal Pictures refused to release Gilliam's cut, and then he recut it, and they still refused. He then took out an ad in Variety to question the studio's decision, which is a bold move, to say the least. And then it was named by LA Film Critics Film of the Year, and then Oscar nominated for Best Screenplay. And then obviously they were forced to back down and release the cut, I think, from what I understand.
The LA Film Critics to see it is because I teach a bit of film school a couple of days. He was doing a film class in America, and he basically said, I'm going to bring a visual aid in. And he screened the students the film.
Oh, wow.
And then the studio said, you cannot do that. And then he kept screening it. So critics were turning up, and that's how the LA Film Critics saw it. And then in the studio, and him and Sid Sheinberg were that over it. And he's actually in the credits, as you know, you've got your gaffer and you've got your best boy, and then you have worst boy, Sid Sheinberg. So it became a real political kind of...
But it's ironic, isn't it, given the film is about, you know, overcoming oppression and stuff.
Crushing creativity and colour and free thinking. So, yeah, it's weird. Life imitates art in that one. But I think I love the...
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The ending as well, the whole, you got that fantasy ending that you think he's escaped, he's got a happy ending and they live happily ever after. Then you realise actually he's still in the middle of the torch, which is flashes back to that incident, occurrence at Owl Creek. I always love that film where you realise the whole film is the flickerings of a dying mind, which I love that story archetype, and that's something in the feature version of Man in Fear that I mentioned is that ending of that flickerings of a dying mind. I'm looking to kind of use in that. I think it's such a strong kind of narrative structure.
I've certainly played with myself because a big influence on me is Jacob's Ladder, which, you know, to invent an entire life while you die, as opposed to your life flashing before your eyes, which is kind of, you know, which is the typical thing, which is why I guess is why it works as a narrative tool, because we expect the past, not the future, from a dying person.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Right then, staying in the 80s, and arguably a film that is fueled by the decade, because it's 1988 when this film comes out, and it was very much a anti-Reagan, anti-neoliberal film. Even though on the surface, it's quite a light film. I mean, it plays well with genre crowds, but it's not a visceral film in any way, but it's what it makes you think about which makes the film so powerful. I mean, narratively, I'm not so sure it holds together too well, but that doesn't seem to matter whenever you watch it. And I'm talking about John Carpenter's They Live.
Again, a great film. And I kind of agree. It's a little bit shonky and rough around the edges, and I didn't, you know, some of the acting's patchy. I didn't realise that the main guy was a wrestler until, which kind of explains a few things, but it's just so packed full of ideas. And again, very visual. Like when we talked about Brazil, I think these two films share some of that. And I think this is an example of an anti-establishment film dressed up in a what if, which means it's entertainment. As you say, it plays to a genre crowd. It's a sci-fi film. It's got this bubblegum, but it's actually asking a lot of big questions. And that whole thing about it was Carpenter's kind of pop at Reagan economics, where you had for the first time in sort of late 70s and the 80s, where you started to see the ultra rich and then everyone else kind of this gap opening up, which now, you know, 20, 30 odd years down the line has just become absolutely polarized. So it was poking that initial opening up and widening of inequality, which is now just is rife. But strange thing, when I rewatched this, I was thinking that all of the idea that we're all kind of, you put sunglasses on and you can see all the truth, and you know, we're all being run by this kind of alien skeletal race.
All right, suppose we settle down. That's far enough. Where'd you get those glasses?
Tooth fairy.
I'll bet.
You got him. Think you saw shaving this morning.
You look as shitty to us as we do to you.
Impossible.
It would be easier if we don't have to splatter your brains. Just take it easy. Hey, you stumbled onto something here. Maybe we can all benefit from this slight misunderstanding. Now, let's go someplace quiet so we can talk this over.
So you bastards die just like we do.
Kind of made me realize that's almost like the foundation of so many like conspiracy theories around now. David Icke and all that were wrong.
Well, yeah.
Goes back to this kind of thing. And you've got this strange thing with Brexit and Trump the last few years, where sort of hard right and hard left almost go round and merge in this weird swamp of conspiracy theories. And if you've got to think, if you are trying to keep control, labeling any challenging of authority as a conspiracy theory is a self-perpetuating is genius. But then we are into the realm now with the internet of
but also Will, it's not even though John Carpenter was responding to Reaganomics, it's inspired by a 1953 short story, 8 o'clock in the morning, by Ray Nelson. So these ideas of conspiracy, of who's running the world, or what reality do we live in, is obviously something that has obsessed people for a long time. You know, you think hard enough, you can create a hypothesis out of anything. And obviously, David Icke, as you mentioned, and the idea that lizards live amongst us isn't a million miles from the skeletal aliens that we see when we put the glasses on. And
the influence of it. Oh, that's the scene in the street where he puts the sunglasses on for the first time and everything around him is, you know, consume, obey, you know, do not question authority. And that scene is just stunning. And the idea, you know, we're all now, you know, you'll get conspiracy theorists saying we're all sheeple, wake up. But the idea of that scene, and then obviously that's inspired Shepherd Fairey and the whole obey thing, which.
Well, that my favourite one of the glasses bit is when you see the magazine stand, which obviously a very staple trope of American cinema, and it's just this black and white bunches of assertions as to how you should be, and the idea that that's the subliminal text that you're really consuming.
But like
the Matrix after it, it's sort of got a life beyond its influence in pop culture is much bigger than just simply a film.
But They Live isn't seen as kind of one of his big three or four films, but I think it's got, like you said, the shadow it's cast, I think, is huge. And you know, the fight scene between the two of them, I've always, as a kid, I loved The Quiet Man, the John Wayne film, and they have that extended fight scene that goes on forever. And when it's him and Frank, his mate, and he's trying to get him to put the glasses on and see the truth, and that's just, it's heartbreaking. Such a great film. I was thinking about other films in this kind of anti-establishment films as a what if, and I was kind of thinking that maybe, you know, Fight Club sprang to mind, but then I didn't put Fight Club on the list, because to me, if you look at like the list of ingredients on it, the side of a tin, you've got the kind of split personality, then you've got the Fight Club, and then the anti-establishment bit that is the almost wish fulfillment of the Tyler Durden character is kind of quite far down the list of ingredients of,
and also it's a bit of a kind of, it's, it could be classed as depression, but you could also read Fight Club as a bit woe is me, as opposed to just, you know, because he's not oppressed in the true sense of the word.
that almost that wish fulfillment, what if, because when you are doing a mind-numbing office job in insurance and living in an IKEA furnished flat, then you kind of, you wish you could escape and do all this, and that's what Tyler Durden is, that wish fulfillment.
Exactly, yeah.
I didn't, They Live kind of definitely topped it when I was weighing up which way to jump on those two.
I mean, it's also that, it's evidence that sometimes the sort of big idea can do a lot for a film. It's like, that's what amazes me about They Live, is that if you were to get the script tomorrow and ask a reader to give you analysis on it, they would tell you what's wrong with it. And it'd be very easy, it'd be hard to argue with them. But because of the kind of almost like pantomime charade aspects to it, and it, you know, it's almost like hitting you on the head with a hammer with its making its point. Moving to France for your fifth and final choice. We're in the streets of Paris the day after a riot, and three kids are trying to work out what to do. We're talking about Matthew Kasovitz's La Haine.
Yeah, 95's La Haine. I guess when you think about bookending these five films I've chosen, we start with The Admirable Crichton, which was very kind of gentle but quite powerful. This is almost the other end of the spectrum. These are quite nice bookends, because this is almost like a savage, nihilistic roar. And I kind of feel that having this kind of this howl of, this is when you talk about the sort of spectrum of anti-establishment films, it's the fact that when you actually strip everything away and people have got nothing, they've got nothing to lose. And this is essentially almost that cautionary tale of, well, when you have got absolutely nothing, then things are going to turn pretty brutal, and there's nothing to stop you. If you haven't got anything to live for, I think, then this is, it's quite bleak and nihilistic, this film. But I mean, it's set in the banlieues of Paris, whereas you said, after a riot, and you see the sort of police brutality, and you see the sort of everyday nature of their lives. I mean, the opening sort of third of the film is very, very loose and naturalistic. And, you know, I found it a little infuriating when they're sitting around on the rooftop talking about Merguez sausages for 10 minutes and nothing really happening. But then you find it's really hypnotic, and you're drawn into this life in this melting pot of the kind of the suburbs of Paris. But you realise that they've got so little, that the lives are kind of, you know, the horizons are very short, that being oppressed, being brutalised by a police force and having, you know, nothing particularly. I find it tragic that the Hooper character is a boxer who is quite promising, but, you know, the gym gets burnt down and he doesn't particularly, he's like, okay, well, that's what it is. You know, I thought maybe I had a shot, but now I haven't. There seems to be so little kind of hope in it, which is really tragic in that film.
Which is kind of why this is almost like the opposite of If, in the sense of the anti-establishment is not because it's a critique of the establishment. It's that the establishment is against the subjects of the film. Whereas, you know, the people who are in If have got a chance to be the establishment and change the world for the better. Whereas the people in La Haine are the victims of the establishment, or survivors. Sorry, I should say survivors of what the establishment imposes on them.
Yeah, une balle. You chuck. Bim.
J'ai raté.
T'es ouf,
toi? J'ai raté!
Attends, c'est des vrais balles!
Attends, c'est classique, ça! C'est bon. Plus rare. Toujours le même tour. Deux balles.
Et... I think in it, there's the tragedy in it is that they are, you know, the whole thing about everyone's fighting over the scraps that are thrown off the table of the haves and these are the have-nots. There's the point they go into Paris because Sides owed some money and they go through all this crap and all these adventures. At the end, it's for 500 francs, which is like 50 quid. And one of them goes, we went through all this for that. And I kind of, that was an element in Concrete Plans where the stakes are so low, but they mean everything to those characters. In Concrete Plans, you know, they're enduring all this, living in a drafty box for months on end for a couple of £1,000, because that's everything. And I always found in the original Point Blank, the Lee Marvin character, he goes on, all this thing happens for the sake of a tiny amount of money, but that's all they've got. They're scratching out this existence. And I find, you know, there's the nihilism in that film, in La Haine, but the recurring thing, that the story they tell all the way through, this bit about the person falling from a tower block, and after every floor they're going, okay, so far so good, and it's not the falling, it's the landing that kills you. And they kind of, they open the film and end the film with that, and they say it in the middle as well. And it's just, that end scene of this is so brutal, and kind of, there's no hope. You built up friendship with these, you've come into their world, And the end scene is just, as you hear the guns going off and you're hearing it's the landing that kills you. And it almost is implying that, oh my God, you know, at some point when society's pulled apart to this extent, it's going to land at some point and that landing is going to hurt. It's going to be really, really tough.
Mm.
And then you think, that was 1995. That was like, you know, 30 odd years ago. Whereas you now think, now you add the boost, the flame of the internet and social media under that, where everything gets even more pulled apart and kind of polarized and supercharged. But God, you know, that landing is coming at some point, and that landing is not going to be soft. And I think it's such a, it's such a hard, tough film, but it's kind of, it draws you into their world, but it's not particularly hopeful film. It's bleak. The ending's brutal. And the kind of, it has to almost be on this list to get that whole spectrum of.
I was interested in reading some of the reviews about it. And it was saying that one of the Empire reviews I read was saying, it's got more relationship with Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing than it has to any French film from that period, which is an interesting idea, you know, because obviously the way, you know, the way that the world looks to French for cinema, and actually, you know, Spike Lee had made such a perfectly, you know, pure cinematic film like Do the Right Thing, which has got a very similar kind of hopeful middle and not hopeful end. Because racism doesn't go away, does it? In La Haine, racism and inequity doesn't go away. You can have a night, you can escape the oppression of the system for a night. You can't escape it. It will come and find you. It's one of my favorite ever cinematic experiences. I was fortunate enough to see La Haine at the Barbican when Asian Dub Foundation did a live score to it, which is an amazing way to see a film. It's very different because obviously you're watching it without any real sound because it's got the subtitles, but it's with it being a French film. No, it's a really exciting thing, but it's a fantastic choice, and it really does. But yeah, it bookends lovely. It bookends beautifully, I guess. A period, you know, you've straddled the 50s through to the 90s of a change, you know, post World War II world in a way where. And all of it, and every one of them, apart from the two in the 80s, which are very much about, you know, one's obviously riffing on what 1984 was really doing, and the other one was basically an early two fingers to neoliberalism when everybody else was getting out of the file of faxes and going, money's great, greed is good. You know, you think of like they, I mean, I know they're not cinematically not classed in the same class, but, you know, Wall Street versus They Live as critiques of Reagan's America, you know, much like Wolf of Wall Street, the people that benefit from these systems see them as codified assurances you're doing the right thing, as opposed to this is saying you're bad. You do know that, don't you?
No, Scorsese was heartbroken when they did a special screening on Wall Street and they're all standing and cheering going, "Woo, yeah." He's going, "This is supposed to be satirizing." And
I must admit, I took no enjoyment from watching the film because I could see while I know what's wrong, the film doesn't seem to pit the things it's doing wrong, the things that are going wrong with any kind of punishment. It just seems to be a bit of out of control, but there's no real, the cost that everybody else pays for that existence.
Yeah.
That's another conversation. So let's just run through your five great anti-establishment films. We've got 1957's The Admirable Crichton. We've got 1968's If. We've got 1985's Brazil. We've got 1988's They Live. And, of course, we've got 1995's La Haine. Having gone through the process of looking back on these films and put this list together, is there any thread that you could identify that brings them together as in your mind? I mean, not, it doesn't have to be any real...
I mean, in terms of there's no singular thread, but I think in terms of looking at them as a spectrum, it was interesting looking at anti-establishment films in terms of they kind of cut to the reason that we go to the cinema and the reason we make films, because, you know, we're all doing a job that we love or hate to some extent to keep the lights on and put food on the table. And there's a kind of degree of escapism to go to the film, to the cinema. It's a low risk way of seeing someone who sticks two fingers up to the system or says, you know, why does it have to be like this? Why is this these families who've been had all the money for hundreds of years, why do we kowtow to them? Because when we were all in the caves, we were all equal. So it's quite nice to I think they all have this degree of either sort of wish fulfillment, idealism of actually, you know, maybe we make a stand, or it's noticeable how much they use allegory and metaphor, because I think, you know, I love sort of social realism films and Ken Loach and Alan Clark and those sorts of films that they're very much, they don't dress up their message. They are very much, it's a one-to-one. And I think there are certain people, I think, who maybe it doesn't cut through. They don't want to go and see a film about how shit their lives are. But when you see I, Daniel Blake, gets questions raised in the House of Parliament, it has power in that way. But I think there's something, all of these films, they tend to dress the message up, or they use allegory, or they give you, on the surface, you can enjoy it as they're entertaining, they'll take you on a thrill ride, they'll make you laugh, they're satire, but they're kind of slipping you a lot of these messages in that way. I kind of, there's that they work on multiple levels, I think, these films. That was one thing I know. The other thing I noticed sitting down and doing this exercise was, like you said, goes from 50s, 60s, 80s, and 90s, and there was nothing post that. And I wondered whether or not our whole sort of anti-establishment tendencies and vocalizing that has maybe moved online since, and we're all too cynical these days. But then when I was thinking about this last night, it struck me, you know, Parasite could have made this list. And that's a very, you know, even the way that's shot, when the richer people are at the top of the frame, the poor are at the bottom. And that kind of made me think from that how the ideas of, you know, late stage capitalism, growing inequality, are universal. We've got France, England, and UK here. In Korea, we used to think, like Bong Joon-ho also did Snowpiercer, which is a very literal society, posh people at the front. And you've got Squid Game recently, which is all, yeah, the heartbreaking point in that, where they go back to their real lives, realize their real lives are crap, and they'll go back into this game where they're probably going to get killed because they might win a few quid. And obviously in Korea, that whole, it seems to be the idea of sort of the level of inequality clearly is focusing minds when you look at a lot of things coming out of Korea recently. So it's interesting how there's a universality to sort of...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, certainly the way that Le Haine is structured. If you look at, say, one of the French extreme horror films, Frontier, which has a similar starting point but goes to a kind of Texas Chainsaw kind of horror. I don't know if you've seen that film. So it starts off with literally a riot in Paris, and a group of Arab teenagers and their friends get a bag of money. So they get themselves €150,000. So they escape to the countryside so they can, while things quiet down after the riots and stuff, so they don't lose the money. And they hole up in, it's the classic urbanoia thing that Carolyn Glover talks about. So they go from fleeing the fear of what they get in the city to the sanctuary of the countryside, and find themselves holed up with a guy who's still living out his Nazi fantasy since occupied France. And it turns into this very extreme horror film, you know, with torture and things like that. But it's interesting, it has the same kickstart point as Le Haine, which is, you know, the city is burning, the city is finished. But in this instance, instead of like just moving from their suburb into different parts of the city, they literally leave the city, but they find even worse horrors waiting for them in the countryside. I mean, again, it's very much, it's more like They Live in its kind of lumpen ways of telling you these things, but it's still no less powerful. I mean, it's still, because the fact I'm still telling you now, it stays in the mind because the idea is strong. And cinema has that ability for you to add these things on top. It doesn't all have to be there in the text. It can just be, it gets you going. I'm sure somebody else watching it will draw a slightly different conclusion. But that was a 21st century horror film. So I think, you know, they're definitely there.
I guess, you know, you can say Get Out is in a different way. It's challenging sort of, well, shining a light on, you know, endemic racism, which is an element of the whole society in terms of the establishment and the old order. They're all kind of part of that same jigsaw, I guess.
And I suppose the big difference is that in the 80s and possibly the 90s, the old empire of whatever we think of as America was very much had won the Cold War, or was winning the Cold War and then won the Cold War. Now, late stage capitalism, or whatever we call this phase we're in now, you could argue America isn't winning that one. And it is imploding in its ability to be, you know, when I was growing up, America was the police of the world. You know, they went and they either influenced or they went and sorted out. You know, you think of Gulf Wars in the early 90s for certain. But they're, you know, all the stuff they did in Central America, which wasn't all that good, you know, to say the least. But now they don't have that. That power is not there anymore. Or that need to do it, even, you know, there isn't an ability to do it like it once was. Now that might be because we've got mobile phones. You know, in the same way the internet has quelled something. On the flip side, a mobile phone has held everybody, a lot more people to account than ever before. Because we didn't have that in the 80s and 90s. So those things have changed.
That's what makes you think, are the kind of anti-establishment films of the future going to be more documentaries and things? The fact that everyone has a movie camera in their pocket are kind of, you know, these, what we've been looking at today are kind of, you know, narrative films and fiction films that are using them to poke messages. Now everyone has the ability to make films. You know, we've seen with the I don't know, from Rodney King and George Floyd, that people having that ability to film, that's what can kind of challenge things and bring things down.
From what we've seen, it's almost like it doesn't even need to be a film anymore, does it? It just needs to be footage of the injustice, and that's enough for it to spark a fuse. But that's for a bigger discussion. Thank you very much for sharing with us your five great anti-establishment films. Do you want to remind people how they can see Concrete Plans?
Yeah, Concrete Plans is on Apple TV. It's on Sky. I think if you subscribe, it's in the free package on there. It's on Now TV as well. Amazon, iTunes, all the basic, pretty much every screening platform, I think, bar Netflix. And a few Q&A screenings will be coming sort of early next year, Omicron permitting. So, yeah.
Indeed. Well, good luck with that. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
Yes. Thanks a lot.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.